Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, Buzzkillers, it's me. It's Professor Buzzkill. And fortunately for you, we have on the line Dr. Scott Hancock, who is an associate professor of history and Africana studies at Gettysburg College. And I've known him for a very long time, and he's one of the best historians around, especially in this field. But most importantly, he's been doing some work, especially this year, out in the public realm. And we need to talk to you about that, Buzzkillers, because it's very, very important. But that I should stop talking and say thank you for coming on the show, Professor.
Uncle, thanks for having me. Pleasure to talk with you. It's been a long time since we talked, Joe.
Yeah, it has been a long time, too long. Can you tell us, first of all, a little bit about yourself and a little bit about Gettysburg College and your scholarly work? Because among other things, when we get to the topic we're going to talk about, you're sort of right there geographically in one of the most important places in Civil War studies.
Yeah, so I came to Gettysburg College in 2001 as a joint appointment. And it's when I first came here, actually, I told them I did not want to be involved in Civil War era studies, that it was at best a minor skirmish. And I had other interesting things to do. But it's difficult to be here and not get pulled into the Civil War era. I don't regret that I have been. So, you know, that's fine. My primary area of research is African-American history. And I like to tell the stories, or try to tell stories of people whom history tends to overlook or discount their significance in the American story. And some of that's related to my previous career, I think, working in group homes with teenage boys, you know, seeing what society tends to do with people who are disadvantaged.
Right, right. Well, that's extremely important. And of course, one of the things that's one of the reasons you're on the show today is because something you've done for society, especially, and it's only really been given the attention it deserves this year. In September 2020, there was a gathering of historians at the Gettysburg battlefield and in other places in the country who were trying to sort of help people who are visiting the battlefield, seeing the sites, seeing the statues, seeing the monuments, understand the greater context. And you got a lot of media, there was a lot of media attention about this year for obvious reasons. Can you tell us how that all came about, or at least this year's gatherings and this year's activism?
Oh, so this year it began kind of actually with a inquiry that I made with the blog Muster. That's the blog of the journal The Civil War Era, which is one of the two leading journals of that era in academia.
Right.
And after the murders of Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd in May, I had contacted them and asked them if they were thinking about having a post that dealt with this and connecting with historical context, because they do a lot of stuff like that. And they actually were kind enough to invite me to write an essay, which wasn't why I contacted them, because it's not really my every expertise. But in the essay that I ended up writing called The Limits of Black Forgiveness, one of the things that I suggested in it is that historians, academic historians, needed to be more proactive and less, not abandon the goal of being objective and having rigorous analysis, but not let that prevent us from entering these kind of very important political, cultural, social, racial discussions at key moments in our society and taking a side, you know, and the side of justice, I would argue. And then on July 4th, as probably you and a lot of your listeners know, there was a lot of armed militia or militia supporters here, a few hundred at Gettysburg National Military Park, in response to a bogus post on Facebook that supposedly Antifa was going to come here. The post said they were going to burn the suburbs of Gettysburg. And as you might remember, when you lived here, there are no suburbs in Gettysburg. You know, so that was
small.
That was the first clue. It was nonsense. But I don't know how many who came. It was a very volatile atmosphere. So some friends of mine and I went out to the Virginia and Mississippi monuments in North Carolina, this Confederate state monuments.
Right, on the battlefield.
With some signs. Yeah, on the battlefield. With some signs that just had quotes from Southern newspapers during the Civil War, making very clear that they were fighting to protect slavery, some information that's backed up by sound historical research about Robert E. Lee and the 189 slaves that he controlled and worked extremely hard and tried to keep them as long as he possibly could and was basically forced to free them mm-hmm. by the Virginia legislature. And our goal was to tell a fuller story and a story that the Confederate monuments obscure and twist. And folks didn't like that. You know, the folks with guns and stuff, they were very unhappy about us doing that. So after July 4th,
right.
My wife, Patty, suggested, why don't you talk to the people at Muster about doing something similar like this at a bunch of Civil War sites across the country? So I contacted them, and in light of my previous post, which I forgot to mention, when I posted that back in June about, it went up on Juneteenth, that historians need to be proactive. One of their questions in response was, well, what can we do? So after July 4th, I said, well, here's something my wife Patty came up with. What do you think? And they were all about it. They were quite excited. So Greg Downs, Kate Mazur, and Hillary Green, they really picked up the ball, did a lot of the organizing. Together, we came up with the hashtag, We Want More History. And they came up with a list of people to sign up. And one of the important things about it was we didn't want this to just be academic historians. Because like the five guys that came with me on July 4th, they're not academic historians. One of them is a welder. One of them is a retired state trooper. One guy works in IT. Another guy's an elementary school teacher. Another one's a retired pastor who does a ministry with former prisoners up near Harrisburg. You know, so we wanted this to be about, this is historians and people in your community who care about this stuff. So that led to us picking a date around the anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's preliminary Emancipation Proclamation on September 22nd. So the following Saturday was September 26th.
And is that why the media attention in happened? Well, a lot of it anyway in September.
Yeah. So on the 26th, 12 to 2 Eastern time, and we wanted it to be simultaneous.
Right.
You know, whatever time zone. Well, I think most of the places were Eastern. There are some in the Central, Chicago, New Orleans. I think there were around a dozen different sites. New York, one in New York, North Carolina, here in Gettysburg. Chicago, New Orleans, Nashville, St. Louis, might have been mm-hmm. Petersburg in Virginia, DC. So, you know, it was, we didn't know if it would be just like me and a couple of people in Gettysburg and maybe, you know, one person in North Carolina. So we felt like it was a good start to this. And it was a more constructive way because the goal. And so I want to make clear to you and your listeners, I'm not opposed to Confederate monuments being removed at all. I think many of them should be and need to be, and the ones that have been, but I also recognize on the national park land, on federal land, it's really difficult to do that. So we need to think about what are some more creative ways that we can use them to educate the public about a fuller story, because they attract a lot of people. So this was meant to be not a protest about removing monuments, although we're not opposed to removal, but this specific thing wasn't about removal. It was more about, can we tell a fuller story? And then communities can decide what they want to do with those monuments, you know, once they know the fuller story.
Now we have a lot of international listeners, and I think a lot of them won't understand or won't know the difference between a national park land, which has a specific sort of legal status, and other places in various communities, but also the fact that we had this Civil War and that on a lot of battlefields and in a lot of cemeteries, there are monuments to the opposing side, the side that tried to secede from the Union. And I think that's unusual in the world. You don't generally see monuments to Germans and on French battlefields and on and on and on. Although there are a number of international peace monuments which recognize everybody. But can you tell us, can you explain the sort of development of that or the idea of why national parks are have monuments that are designed this way?
Yeah, that's a good point. So, and one, a little bit of the legal context, when monuments are on federal land, it literally takes an act of Congress to decide if anything about the monument, if the monument is going to be removed or installed.
Yeah.
So that's different from monuments that are in a town square where people in a town can decide that we don't want it anymore.
Right.
So that's what I mean when I say it's a much more difficult process if it's on federal land. But yeah, so these national federal parks like Gettysburg National Military Park or Antietam or Chancellorsville or Petersburg, a host of others, a lot of those Confederate monuments start going up in the early 20th century. There's a few that are earlier, and those are different from ones in cemeteries and town squares and stuff right. like that. And many of them go up in the civil rights era because often it's about, they come when there's a like 50th anniversary of the Civil War or something like that. There's a movement to put up a monument. And you know, there's a degree of remembrance when I remember those who have died, but a lot of it is about the part of what happens after this, in the decades after the Civil War, is many white Southerners start to argue, they start to rewrite the history mm-hmm. that slavery really had little or nothing to do with the war. That the war was not about black people, that African Americans were peripheral at best, because it's a country where white Southerners, for the most of them, and they're not monolithic, but most of them, they don't want to think that they went through this, sacrificed all of this because of black people, because black people are at the bottom of the,
right.
you know, the political, economic, social, racial hierarchy in their minds. So they're distancing themselves from that. And it's about creating a notion and reinforcing a notion of white supremacy and whiteness. And mm-hmm. and part of that is also accepted by white Northerners, a big part of that eventually. And it's, you know, white Northerners, mixed responses to that, but eventually over time, as you go through the 20th century, white Northerners by and large accept that. And they identify white Confederates, all the Confederates were white.
And yeah, right.
Some people will say black people fought for the Confederacy. No, they did not.
We've had a show about
that. Okay, great. So the Confederates identify themselves as Americans, which they always had, said they're American. And part of what changes is white Americans outside the South increasingly begin to accept that definition, that yes, you're always American. You're just as patriotic as we are. Robert E. Lee is probably the best example of that, where he's considered a traitor and committed treason, but he's kind of accepted back into the fold, especially after he dies. You know, it's easier when after somebody dies. And so he really gets sanitized. And my goal and our goal at this is not to say, oh, Robert E. Lee was a terrible, awful person. I mean, maybe he was, I don't know, but he was certainly not without stain. You know, had some reprehensible attitudes toward African Americans, and he was a great general in many ways. Wasn't a perfect general, but he was a great general. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be telling a more complete story about him as a human being.
Now, the thing about this, the media attention of the September 2020 gatherings, et cetera, and all the stuff that happened this summer about monuments, this year about monuments going down, that sort of leaves out the fact that you've been doing this activism for a while, at least back to 2015. Am I right about that? Is that when you started to go to the battlefield with signs, contextual signs, and try to talk to people?
Yeah, well, in town and on the battlefield. Okay. Yeah. It started in 2015 after the Charleston Nine were assassinated in Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, by a white supremacist. And so that was June 2015. And as you may recall, and some of your listeners may know, there was a national movement to remove Confederate flags from like Walmart, Gettysburg National Military Park, the store here, stop selling Confederate flags unless it was explicitly attached to something historical. So if it was a book about the Confederate Army, had a Confederate flag on the cover, that was okay. But if it was a teddy bear wearing a Confederate flag, they stopped selling that.
Oh, Lord. They didn't really have teddy bears with Confederate flags.
They had stuff like that. I don't know if they had teddy bears, but they had stuff like that. Yeah, which probably they should have never had, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
But so in response to that, what happened in Gettysburg, like on the block where I live, is three of our neighbors, not like immediate next to my house, but on the block, put out Confederate battle flags off their front porch. And in town, the center of town, there's a rotary in the center of town. And on July 4th of that year, there were many people with Confederate flags. And so it was basically people doubling down.
A traffic circle in the middle of. Yeah, we don't want to offend rotary clubs because that's not what.
Yeah, the traffic circle. Yeah. And I was talking to a neighbor of mine who's actually a communications professor and just saying, I'm just sick of this, that we see the Confederate flag here in Gettysburg more often at times like this, the American flag. There's no annual celebration of emancipation at the end of slavery here, but we have this kind of annual commemoration. And I would argue it's a celebration of the Confederacy when they lost, you know, they lost here. So he commented, my neighbor commented that Confederate flags and mine and stuff are a form of discourse. And right now the discourse is all one.
Right. So right now, meaning 2015 ish when you were started. Yeah.
2015. Yeah. Yeah. So I thought, well, somebody, there needs to be another voice. Right. And so I talked to my wife, Patty, and my daughter-in-law made me a sign. The sign says slavery, 1863, because that's when the Battle of Gettysburg was. Segregation, 1962, and that was just symbolizing the Confederate flag becomes really popular in the South after World War II in response to federal orders that they have to dismantle legalized racism and Jim Crow. So it was a symbol of resistance to protect white supremacy. And then it had some Confederate flags, some small images of Confederate battle flags. And then at the bottom, it said murder 2015 because the assassin in Charleston had a Confederate battle flag and other Confederate imagery. So I took my sign. The next weekend is the bike parade here in Gettysburg. I don't know if you remember that. 10,000 motorcyclists come to Gettysburg.
Yeah, it's pretty noisy.
Town of 8,000 people. And I thought, I bet there's going to be another display of Confederate flags at the traffic circle.
Oh, sure, sure.
So went out and just took my sign and stood there. And I want to make clear, I don't enjoy doing this at all. It is not fun. It's gut-wrenching. But the one thing I learned from doing that is a lot of people talked to us. Most of them were not happy. They were arguing. They weren't physically threatening.
Mm-hmm.
But we had many conversations. So I thought, well, anytime I know there's going to be this kind of celebration of the Confederacy, the Confederate flag, Confederate monument symbols, then I and anybody else who wants to, I want to make sure there's somebody who's speaking back if we can do so peacefully. So yeah, that's when it started. And since then, there have been different iterations of that it hasn't been. It's not like this happens, every month. It's once a year, a couple times a year.
No, but this summer is a high point in Gettysburg, as I remember, right? Because, of course, the battle's in the summer, with the anniversary of the battle's in the summer. And then there's, of course, the bike thing, as you say, the motorcycle thing, as you say. And people who don't know Pennsylvania or don't know the United States very well won't realize that Gettysburg itself is close to what's known as the Mason-Dixon line, the traditional dividing line between North and South in the United States. And because it's also very easy to get to from places in the South, Northern Virginia and its other places, on these anniversaries, you get a lot of people from, I don't want to say both sides because that's not really right to say in 2020, but you get a lot of people from a lot of different parts of the country come up to Gettysburg or come down to Gettysburg. It's very, very central.
Yes. Yeah. And it's not far from some major urban centers within 3 hours of three and a half hours of four cities that are huge, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, D.C.
Right.
And so Gettysburg, like I said, town of 8,000 people, about 1 million visitors a year. And the majority of those in the summer, like you said.
Yeah. And it is amazing. 1 million visitors to a town that's tiny. So did you continue this through 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019?
Yeah, 26, and I'm not sure if I'm going to remember all the. And I said, it's not constant.
Yeah.
It's probably been since 2015, maybe 7-8 times. So, 2016, there was a commemoration of Confederate National Flag Day in March at the Peace Light. About 200 supporters of the Confederate flag and came out. So mm-hmm. about 80 of us showed up with signs.
80?
Yeah, and actually this people keep asking me. They asked me this summer and before. They think that I'm like with Antifa or I'm with some national organization. I keep telling people this is how the level of organization, like for this July 4th, the level of organization was Thursday night. I sent an email to five friends saying, hey, this is what I'm doing Saturday. Do you want to come? Friday night, my wife made the signs.
Right.
And the video that maybe that you and some other people have seen, those are some filmmakers I never even knew. They called me Friday morning and said, hey, we hear you might be doing something. Do you mind if we come film? And I said, yeah, sure. If you want to, you know, feel free.
Yeah, we're going to put the links to the YouTube version of that in the New York Times article on the blog post for this episode.
Okay, yeah. And I mean, September 26th was definitely a more organization because it was these other three historians. But again, that's four of us.
Yeah.
Sending emails. And in 2016, the only thing I did was I applied for a permit to have a sign to stand at the peace light by myself and maybe with my family. And then people just started, they heard that I applied for a permit and people just started emailing, say, hey, can I come?
Well, that's great.
I said, yeah, you can come if you want to. And so it ended up, being like 70, 80 people. And a few of those were Antifa people, which I didn't know that before.
Yeah.
They were not violent. I know, I'm sure I don't want to get into that whole debate, but the Antifa people that came then were not violent. I don't know that no Antifa people are violent, but they weren't. Some of their language is was a bit raw at times. Yeah. and then there are a couple other times when I've gone out with my sign on the battlefield. 2017, there was a bogus Antifa post. A bunch of people came out with guns on the battlefield like this year. So I went out and my different family members joined me. Isaac was out there with me for a while. My son, youngest son. Up until this year, it's really been pretty much me and my family and occasionally a couple of friends here and there, except for September in 2016 was the only time when there was a significant number of other people in the community who also came out.
Right. Do you think this summer was significantly different because of the other monuments coming down earlier in the year? And, it's been until COVID got worse and worse and worse. That was perhaps the biggest news in American society.
I think the biggest news other than COVID since May was Black Lives Matter protests and all the controversy.
The Confederate aspect.
Yeah, but that's connected. Right. Definitely connected. And so some of this is speculative on my part because I'm not a sociologist nor a psychologist or anything like that. But I think
historically
we know that things like this tend to happen when there's multiple sources of tension in society that are kind of converging at the same time. And this summer was different because, like I said, 2017, there were people with guns who were talking to us. 2017, I never felt like my physical safety was at risk. This year was completely different than any other time that I've been out in town or in the battlefield. People were just angry. There was really no interest in having any kind of intelligent conversation.
Yeah.
The response was absolutely about shutting us down. And I commented to one of my friends, the only free speech they care about is their own.
Right, sure.
Yeah, the level of hostility and anger and threat was much greater than it has been in the past.
Do you mind telling Buzzkillers how you personally and presumably other people that were there handled this tension? Because, of course, I know you, and I know you as perhaps the calmest person in the world, not only for calm reasons, but because you want to have this dialogue, wouldn't enter into a shouting match with people. But how it would be very difficult for me to not respond sharply to a lot of these people. How were you able to try to keep the message on, let's contextualize this, when there's shouting in your face or if there are guns? If there are guns, I would immediately leave, but you're braver than I am.
Stupider maybe. Yes, and that's a good question. So I think there's a variety of things that go into that. And one is, like I referenced earlier, so the years that I spent working in group homes, I think that It's a skill you develop, how you deal with angry people.
Right. And group homes, by the way, are for foster children who have are in the system and have to be placed in a group home to get out of a bad family situation, right?
Yeah, that's one form. The group home that I worked in was more teenage boys who had run afoul of the law for various reasons. Okay. But some would have been in what you described, like foster kids were kind of between placement. But it's basically young men who have a lot of, often get angry because there's a lot going on in their lives they cannot control. And they've been put in difficult positions and made bad choices. But anyway, all those years of, I think, working with, you know, in tense situations, I think you develop, it's a skill you develop like anything else, right?
Right.
And, but I think some of it is also, so I think two other things. One is, and as you know, Joe, so I would identify as a Christian, as a follower of Jesus Christ. And
right.
And I think part of that, and I know it's not that Christianity is the only faith system that believes this, but I think part of that is recognizing that people have value and people are made in the image of God. And so even people that I disagree with profoundly, mm-hmm. even if they're being threatening or rude or racist, because they were yelling racist stuff at us, that I have to try to remember, they still matter, right? They still have value,
right?
Despite the behavior that they're deciding to engage in. And so I have to treat them with respect and dignity. And I'm not saying I do that 100% of the time by any stretch,
yeah.
But that's the goal, you know, trying to remember that. And that's part of the reason, like, so if any of your viewers see the video, and I'm not trying to drive up the numbers, it's not my video, it's the filmmaker, the documentary filmmaker. And I don't even know if it's in the video. One of the things that I try to do when I talk to people is I try to ask them their name and tell them my name.
Yeah.
Because it's just a way to remind me and hopefully remind them we're people.
Yeah.
Right. You're not an issue. You're a person. The majority of the time in truth, that doesn't help a lot to defuse the situation,
right.
But you know, I think it sometimes it does help a little bit. But the other thing also is I think I have facts on my side.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and so I mean, like, man, you can yell at me all you want. What you're arguing with is actually not me. What you're arguing with is the truth.
Right. Right.
And, you know, you're going to lose every time. So as long as I try to avoid letting it become personal and just keep pointing back to, okay, here's the evidence.
Yeah.
You know, so how do you respond to the evidence? Then that helps. Like I said, it's not like I do it perfectly. One of the things that's not in the video is when they were taking pictures of our license plates and the motorcyclists who would not let us leave. Well, they would not leave. They were waiting for us to get in our car so they could follow us, which they did for like 2.5 miles after we got in our cars.
This is fairly serious. I mean, this is, again, something that would have made me extremely nervous.
Oh, yeah. These people were – it was just kind of off the charts. And although, I mean, it could have been worse. You know, there were no shots fired or anything like that. So,
sure.
You know, when they were doing stuff like that, I was I wasn't intentionally taunting them, but I was saying things like, okay, we're all good Americans, right? You're good citizens.
Yeah.
Which I don't think they were acting like good citizens in that moment.
Right.
But
there's value in saying it and trying to remind them of the idea that there is a thing called a good citizen and we should try to behave that way.
Yeah. Although I know, truth be told, I was trying to remind him of that, but to some extent, I there was a little bit of sarcasm in my comment.
Oh, okay.
You know, because so it was some of both, because it felt like, okay, you're all talking about being patriotic and being Americans. Act like it.
Right. You know, right. Well, one of the things I noticed, and I think Buzzkillers will notice in the video, and I know this from other times I've spent time with you, is when you're talking to someone, well, for instance, in these September confrontations, Buzzkillers won't be able to see this from our conversation, but people are often pointing while they're arguing with you, and they're pointing down or with their fist. You know, if you point at someone, you're often pointing with your fist down, and you're responding. You personally are responding while you're talking with your hand out, palm up. Right now, I know this is part of the way you talk, and it may be part of the training from when you worked in group homes and everything. But that's a very open and welcoming way to say to try to express this idea. Let's have a conversation about this. Let's not jab and point and try to hurt one another, I have this information that I know to be very solid. Please think about it. I've always been amazed at how you're able to continue to do that in the face of such hassle, but how well it seems to work.
Yeah, that actually, I hadn't thought about that, but you're
if you watch the film, it's very noticeable.
Yeah, I somebody sent it to me when they first posted it, and I watched it when it had like 4 views, and then I didn't watch it again until September or August when University of New Hampshire, where I got my graduate degree, did a webinar with me about it, and it was actually somewhat traumatic. Well, traumatic might sounds a little bit too dramatic, perhaps, but watching it again was not easy.
Yeah,
and so I haven't watched it a third time, and don't plan to unless for some reason. But I remember what you're talking about. I just hadn't thought about it. But yeah, I think you're right. So that's Professor Buzzkill's analytical skills coming to the
forefront. Right, that's right? Me. Yeah, I look at people's hands.
No, but you're right. But you're absolutely right, because so I wouldn't say that I was consciously making sure that my hand was open, but it is definitely conscious to not point.
Yes. Yeah.
When you're arguing, because that's, like you said, it's aggressive, right? It's there's nothing friendly about that. I mean, I wouldn't do that to my kids.
No, sure.
I wouldn't do that to my wife. You know, I wouldn't do that to other people.
I think it's very important. And also to think of ourselves in generally when we talk with people, argue with people, discuss with people, that even if we're not actually pointing and being aggressive like that, we may be setting across that tone in our voice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and other body language.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Professor, there are so many things that have been so important about this and so good about this. I want to make sure, though, we talk about something called hashtag We Want More History. Let me give you a brief story about why I think this is so wonderful and so important. When we first started this show, I thought no one is going to listen to a history podcast. They're going to be bored. They're going to think of us like going back to school. Let's have a panel and get some comedians on, and we'll joke around and we'll talk about this, and we'll get a little bit of history through to people. Well, after 6 months of that, people, especially my friends, started saying, no, 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 we want the real stuff. We don't want to listen to a bunch of half-baked jokes about Napoleon. We want to know the full story. And once the show took a much more content-laden, if you will, turn, our numbers went through the roof. In other words, they were saying to me, we want more history, but you have come up with, and your groups have come up with this hashtag, we want more history, and a fabulous t-shirt to go along with it. But when I asked you about this before the show, because now that I'm in quote show business, I'm asking you, oh, can I put the t-shirts on the Buzzkill bookshelf and sell them and everything? There's a better story about it behind it than what I had thought there would be. So tell us that story.
Okay. Yeah. So, And actually, I don't want to take full credit for this by any stretch. So I mm-hmm. came up with 2 hashtags for our September 26 event. And right. And then Hillary Green, who's the editor for Muster, who's much more media savvy than I, said, yeah, the We Want More History one is the better one. And she's absolutely right. And it was actually Greg Downs' idea in the first place to have a hashtag. So I think that's, you know, it's a collaborative effort. But the reason that was one of the ones I came up with is because I've been telling people for the last year or so, when we hear this stuff that we're trying to erase history, say, one, I make my money off of history. Why would I want to erase it?
Right, right. And two, and we're rolling in it, right?
Right, yeah. And two is we want more of it.
Right.
You know, because we understand that the Confederacy, and this happens in many places around the world, right? Whether you're talking about the Spanish Civil War or a host of other places, where there are huge aspects that get silenced or obscured or twisted for intentional political, cultural, social, and racial purposes.
Right.
Right. So we want more history to uncover the ways in which it has been obscured and why it's been obscured.
Right.
And if we have time, I can give you 2 brief examples from the Gettysburg Battlefield of that I think illustrate.
No, please
that.
Do. Please do. Yeah.
So once you came with the hashtag, again, this I think goes back to the you know, people think it's some brilliant level of organizing.
I do.
Yeah. So our neighbor, and I mean literally our neighbor, like I'm looking outside my window at her house right now, is a graphic designer. And she loves this stuff that we're doing. And she came out in the battlefield with us once to So she designed the font and the hashtag and how it looks on the t-shirt.
Yeah.
And then she told us, yeah, you can order these iron-on things through Walmart. So we went around to like $5 Generals because each one only had like four or five t-shirts, the right sizes. So we went around town, bought these t-shirts, tried to make sure they're Hanes t-shirts because we wanted to make sure it was a company that had some kind of ethical sourcing of their labor, which Hanes is, they're not great, but they're not terrible, you know. So we went around, spent the afternoon driving around town, buying these t-shirts, ordered the iron-ons through Walmart and Amazon, spent Friday night ironing the We Want More History onto these shirts.
Well, and it looks great. They're great.
Yeah, and that's, you know, so that's the brilliance behind them. But the irons-on, what I told you is the iron-ons will wash off after about 15 washes. You know, so we don't want to sell them to people and then have them say, hey, what, you know, coming back a few months later saying, hey, it faded. But actually now, because there's actually been several people who have expressed interest. So we found a company that seems to have a fairly ethical labor chain and the t-shirts are affordable and they're going to print them. So it's actually real printing that won't wash off.
Right.
And so when those are available, we can let you know. And just so people know, we're not looking to make money off of these. I think we get like $4 per shirt. And the plan is to donate that to things like the establishment of the Gettysburg Black History Museum, things like that. So, it's, you know, it's not like we're going to become t-shirt magnates off of this. But so.
Right. Well, we hope to be able to sell them on our website. The graphic is great. You know, it's just absolutely great. It's very, especially since you put them on black t-shirts, it stands out very, very well. But there are these two great stories about the t-shirts that you wanted to tell us. So let's hear those.
Okay. Well, these are the stories that I think generated the thinking about why we want more history, right? Why we want to tell visitors more history. It's not about erasing history. So the Mississippi State Monument on the Gettysburg National Military Park, which is a great sculpture, your listeners can Google it. It was put up in 1973, talks about it, began during the 1960s. And the inscription on it says that our brave sires fought for their righteous cause.
Uh-huh.
And so I say, well, let's talk about what they said in the 1860s about what their cause was. For instance, the Mississippi Declaration of Secession, which you can also Google, makes very clear right at the start, they are fighting to protect slavery because it's basically the economic dynamo of the world.
Right, yeah.
And they're very conscious of this. So what we've talked to the National Park Service here about doing, and they have said it's in the works, they're going to do this, is let's put signs up by the Mississippi Monument that tell visitors this is what their cause was.
Right.
When that monument goes up in 73, the superintendent, his name was George Emery, he wrote back to the Mississippi committee, says, you can't say righteous cause because that's an opinion. You can say they fought for their cause, but you can't call it righteous because that's a political opinion and we're trying to avoid that. The committee pushes back. They get Tom Brady to write to the superintendent. Tom Brady was a state Supreme Court justice in Mississippi, extremely racist. He was absolutely against Brown v. Board, which outlawed segregated schools based on race in 1954, said plenty of racist things about black people. So that's who Mississippi chooses to represent their argument that their cause was righteous.
It's incredible.
And the reason that inscription gets put on there is because George Emery, the Gettysburg superintendent, leaves his job other reasons. And the guy that replaces him, Jerry Strober, is a white guy from Mississippi. And so that's the inscription that has been on there for going on 50 years now. Mm-hmm. The other story is the South Carolina Monument, which was put up in 1963, right in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement, a couple of months before Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And it says on it that they fought for the sacredness of states' rights.
Yeah.
And this is, so for some of your international listeners and others, When the South rewrites the history of the Civil War and they write slavery out of that history, that slavery was a cause, they use this euphemism, we fought for states' rights.
Yeah.
And the easy question is, well, what's the main state right they were fighting for? Because the answer is to keep slaves. But they'll say, well, it's states' rights, it's about independence, resisting the power of the federal government, of the centralized government. The one of the main dedication speakers in July of 1963 was George Wallace, who is governor of Alabama and a huge proponent of segregation.
Yeah.
He says in his speech that the South will continue fighting for constitutional and individual rights, and he gets a standing ovation because his white listeners knew that in 1963, when he says they're going to fight for individual and state individual and constitutional rights, what he means is the right to maintain a racist white supremacy and legalize Jim Crow in the South. Right.
During the 1960s. Yeah.
They're going to resist the federal government's orders to desegregate. And I don't love that the monument says this, but the great irony is behind that monument is the South Mountain Range. And we know that through that range, black people use those mountains to escape slavery, you know, to guide them north.
Oh, right. Okay.
And further north from Gettysburg is a guy, William Wright, in York Springs. He was an abolitionist, and he was part of the Underground Railroad helping escaping black people find freedom. And the South Carolina Declaration of Secession, it has a long preamble. And then the first reason, and really the only main reason that they list why they're leaving the Union, is because the federal government won't do anything about the fact that northern states are not helping them capture escaping slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1860, South Carolina was basically saying, we don't like the fact that the federal government isn't suppressing the rights of northern states.
Yeah.
And helping us get these black people back into slavery. So right behind this monument that says they fought for states' rights are the mountains that tell the truth about what is being lied about on that monument.
Yeah.
You know, so you have this incredible juxtaposition. And again, the Gettysburg National Military Park is working to tell some of that story so that when these million visitors come through Gettysburg and they see those monuments, they don't see this glorification of the Confederacy. They see these monuments about a institution that fought to protect slaves and then its descendants fought against civil rights.
Right, right. Okay, well, I'm sure that you will very modestly say that the things you've done since 2015 are only part of the reason the National Park Service is doing these things. But I want a Buzzkill to know this is highly significant. And as you say, even though only a few of you got together in the beginning and started it, lots of people joined you. And we see this across the country, especially across the South. An awful lot of these removals of monuments and other things start off with a couple of people, and then there's a huge crowd there when it happens. So not only do we want more history, we can actually, by working on it and getting more history and reading more history, we can start to change things as we start to understand it better.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you think about what Bree Newsom, the African-American woman who climbed the flagpole in South Carolina and took the Confederate battle flag down in 2015.
Yeah.
One person was a big part of starting this kind of movement.
Right.
And you're right, like you said. So what we're doing here matters, but it matters because it's a piece of what many, many other people are also doing in conjunction with this.
Well, we can't thank you enough, Professor, for coming on the show, and we'll hope you'll come on again. We have lots of topics I know that you are expert in and our listeners would like to hear about. So it just remains for me to say thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. This has been great talking to you.
And we'll talk to all you buzzkillers out there next week.